The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and on this week's show, I meet up with French femme Audrey Tautou to find out about her new film, Priceless.
The first time I tried my costumes, I was thinking how my boobs will stay behind this little piece of fabric. I was just obsessed by that.
Yes, after mastering the act of keeping her boobs in her skimpy dresses, she goes on to put in a fine, sexy performance as a high-class tart with a questionable heart. More of that later. Of course, due to our David Lean special last week, not meaning to blame the great man himself, we missed out on giving you our penny's worth on the most glamorous release of the year. Yes, Sex in the City, out of the box set, onto the big screen, and Guardian style guru Hannah Poole will be joining me to judge if anything was gained or lost in translation. But first, recently we talked with film historian Peter Biskin about the dearth of truly indie cinema in America these days. But one filmmaker holding on by his fingernails to low-budget, top-quality filmmaking is LA-based director Alex Holdridge. His film, In Search of a Midnight Kiss, is a very funny, vulgar and touching look at that age-old staple, the search for love. The film, shot in ravishing black and white, is set in the run-up to New Year's Eve in downtown LA. The story follows unlucky Wilson, played by Scoot McNairy, and his impromptu online date with the seemingly vampish Vivian, played by Sarah Simmons. It could be the sleeper hit of the summer, so I met up with Alex Holdridge and his leading lady Sarah Simmons to find out more. Congratulations, guys. This is the first place on Earth that In Search of a Midnight Kiss is coming out in London. I feel very proud of this because I kind of discovered your film at the Edinburgh Film Festival last year and recommended it to Vertigo Films and said, oh, this would be a good little indie thing that I haven't seen for a while. And they picked it up and you're here now from LA.
Yes, no, it's a great honor. No, playing, I remember that very, very well, having come from Los Angeles and ending up in Edinburgh and watching this, and you're making this, you made this very personal film about you and your friends and, you know, their own romances and sexual perversions and sense of fun that they have with one another, and it was certainly an honor to see it with an audience in the UK, and then for it to be received well. And I remember reading your review and feeling extraordinarily excited about the potential, and the fact that we're here is just kind of we can only be humble and very, very excited about the whole experience.
What I love about the film is its kind of low fineness, is its kind of its very indie-ness. What was it like actually shooting? It looks like you did it very kind of guerrilla style. Doesn't look like there's a lot of trailers and special effects in this one, Sarah.
Right, no special effects, not at all. It was guerrilla style, very much so. We had no permits at all. We were walking the streets of downtown LA, finding locations sometimes on the spot. We had little time to shoot the entire film, so we just went with it and just right. Full force.
Yeah. And it looks, I mean, it is downtown LA that I found it very seductive. I thought the cinematography was beautiful. It kind of obviously reminds you of Manhattan and Gordon Willis, the kind of the montage that's done there, that I mean that in the best way. And then I saw the camera that you shot it on. I mean, you know, it's the sort of thing you'd use to do your kid's birthday party.
That's right. Had we had a little bit more money, had I more credit left on my Visa, we probably could have gotten even a better camera. But no, those cameras have amazing image quality, and so we kind of knew that we could capture enough pixels to get what we wanted. And so, my very good friend Robert Murphy, who also acts in the film, he shot it, and we'd been working together for, over 10 years, shooting little indie films on the streets. And so we became very accustomed to shooting quickly and being terrified that a security guard's going to kick us out. And our kind of running theme was that we were shooting a wedding video. So if you're a young person that's got a script and you want to shoot it, just go out on the streets, hide all the audio equipment in your jacket. Everyone wears wireless mics. And if anyone bothers you, just say you're shooting a wedding video, and that's how you do it.
But I always find that, I mean, I love if you think of Breathless or the Jean-Luc Godard, the new waves, I love the sound of the traffic. One of my favorite films is William Klein's documentary about Muhammad Ali, when he follows him around the Florida fight with Sonny Liston. I mean, you can hardly hear any dialogue because the buses and the traffic, and that kind of adds to the charm.
No, it's the flavor. The flavor of the city was incredibly important. And both Robert and I, the cinematographer, are obsessed with those little details. So being down in Los Angeles, you see all of these interesting little things. You know, people that are, older waiting for the bus, and decrepit little clocks where, birds are flying out. And you find these little things that just kind of are in your environment that you see every day that kind of, you know, become kind of the patina of your everyday existence. And so it was just natural for us to want to capture all of that.
This film, I know, Alex, came from a kind of depressing place. I mean, it's a charming, lovely film that's full of kind of, you know, the highs and lows of love and life. But it actually came from quite a dark spot. Out of necessity came this this kind of breakthrough film for you.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it was like, you know, you're on the indie circuit and you're doing these little films, but really you're just, your credit card is filling up with ever-increasing debt, and you're just constantly working these awful, you know, little jobs, waiting tables and delivering chicken at night and everything you could possibly imagine just to pay rent.
You weren't dressed as a chicken.
No, but if they were paying me more, I would have. It wasn't a moral dilemma. And so, yes, so for all of a sudden, you know, to be able to, you know, and we had a big development deal at a studio, and ultimately the project fell through. And so out of that, it was kind of like a 5-year project, 5 years of work down the drain. And, you know, all of these awful things had befallen me in this brief period of time where you crash your car, you lose a tooth, your girlfriend of 5 years leaves you, and all of a sudden you're on the awful Hollywood apartment floor and just wondering, like, where did my life go? Your laptop is gone. Everything that makes you you, you just feel like you're one step away from, you know, begging for change on the street. And all of a sudden that was when, you know, my closest friend calls up and is like, I got an HD camera, let's shoot something. And so we just all dove in, and that it was just born like almost, I don't even remember the writing process because I wrote the whole script in 2 weeks, which is just such an anomaly because I tend to just overwrite and write and write and write. Mm-hmm. I mean, my last script took a year to finish until I was finally felt like, okay, it's ready.
I think that's kind of the theme of the movie, though. We had no time to think, so you just went with it, and it's acting as well. Yeah. You know, I had no time to really create a character or, you know, take 6 months beforehand to do this, and Alex just kept saying, you know, trust yourself, just do it. Same way with writing, you just had to mm-hmm. trust yourself and just go with it because we had no time. It's right. Like, let's just do this.
I don't want to be left alone. So just stick around with me till midnight. At midnight, you could go. You could go home at midnight. You could do whatever you want. I mean, every year I'm going to, on New Year's Eve, I'm going to think I just sit this girl home in tears. I'm going to wonder what happened to you. So just let me take you out to dinner. No, I want to do something nice for you.
You don't have to do that.
No, honestly, let me take you out. I have $100 in my bank account. I'm going to go out, and I'm going to pulse it out, and I'm going to take you wherever you want to go. Any restaurant in this town. I mean, as long as it's not more than $50 per person minus the tip.
What appeals about this film is its very personal aspect. I don't want to go into too much autobiographical detail here, but, you know, many of the events seem to have been very true, and when I've seen it with audiences, that's exactly when they laugh, those kind of piercing recognitions of one's own foibles up there on the screen.
Yeah, that is. Well, it was funny because the first time we showed, I got into this very serious car crash. I walked away unharmed, but I took a photo out of the car upside down just because at that point, like, I'm in the middle of the desert on my drive from Austin, Texas to Hollywood, you know, my big move. I have $150 in my pocket and no margin for error. And all of a sudden, my car's upside down in a ditch. Everything I own is scattered across the freeway. And I find this little throwaway camera that my friend handed me before I left. And I just, days, just leaned down and snapped a photo. And that photo is actually used in the movie as kind of part of the backstory. And so, you know, it was funny because the first time we showed it, as soon as that photo popped up in the context of the film, everybody laughed. Mm. And we all kind of looked at each other like, wow, people only knew that was actually a real moment. But in the context of, you know, once you're removed from it, you know, the series of kind of ill-fated years, it's certainly a humorous thing to look at, not to live.
Well, I think it's a very, very funny film. I laughed a lot from when I first saw it. It starts with one of the best gags of the year, kind of a masturbation gag. You're not involved in that one, Sarah,
no,
unfortunately.
That's part two.
Right, the sequel.
I'll get my masturbation scene.
I'm going there.
Just tell us a little bit about your character, because she's a kind of amalgam of all the kind of girls you fall in love with in films, but she's pretty smart-mouthed.
Very smart-mouthed. I think I use the F word quite a few times, but Vivian, she's, you know, a little neurotic, a little crazy in the beginning, and she's just looking for love in a city that's pretty hopeless. And so she decides to find the right guy for her on New Year's Eve, and she's going to interview them to make sure that she chooses the right one, and she chooses Wilson, and then we go on, and I think later you you realize why she is so abrupt in the beginning. You know, you learn a little bit about her and that she does have a heart there. So it was a very fun character to play. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, she's great. I think she's kind of up there with the Annie Halls and the Julie Delpys in Before Sunset. Yeah. That kind of girl, that kind of mysterious girl behind the dark glasses, but smoking habit.
Yeah.
You want to quit?
Right. Pills and alcohol, you know, whatever it takes.
Just a quick word before we go about the indie scene, because this kind of reminded me of those great indie discoveries of the 80s and the 90s, the Jarmusches and the Hal Hartleys, if you like, that kind of quite quirkiness, that offbeatness, which many have tried to kind of keep emulating, but seems to have disappeared from the scene. I know you're both from Texas. Is that where the indie spirit is? I know Linklater kind of spawned it there, and I mentioned Before and After Sunset.
Yeah, well certainly Richard Linklater is a good friend of mine, a big inspiration, certainly artistically in the film world. He's also has, you know, a great film scene there that he's been cultivating and showing films and showing, you know, European films on a Tuesday night. And so I'm certainly a benefactor of having been able to watch all these fantastic films and, you know, all sorts of filmmakers from Quentin Tarantino on come to town to show the reels of the films that they love. And I'm 100% a product of that. And like you said, these filmmakers that were, you know, making these indie films in the 90s, but not quite like the indie scene it is right now, which I feel is almost so much a result of technology that things almost are very sloppy and faux documentary and kind of they're not necessarily engaged at the beginning with the real concept and a real kind of, I don't want to say respect for film history, but certainly the filmmakers in the 90s that you're referring to, which are a big inspiration to me, are well aware of the 70s filmmaking scene, which are, you know, really an outgrowth of the, you know, French New Wave and these films in the 60s, which, you know, themselves were critics and very aware of films that preceded them. So I feel like, you know, just part of a very, very long, you know, filmmaking history for which I have a tremendous amount of respect and am certainly influenced by. And, you know, I feel like it was only right to refer to that. And so because the story is so modern, I chose a very, very classic aesthetic. So it's with a longer lens, as long as possible for that type of a camera, where everything is really, you know, the rules of, you know, cinematic choices are really the same as in The Third Man, you know, from, you know, 40s British cinema. You know, when you use a two-shot, when you do an over-the-shoulder. And these are things that you know, if you're incredibly into film, you can, upon analysis, like, understand why you're making these decisions.
But that's why I was thinking, Brief Encounter and everything from Abu Dessouf and Bon Départ all the way up to Annie Hall, because that long line is there, and that's what makes the film so appealing. Listen, I hope it's going to be a big breakout success. I got a feeling that it has this kind of sleeper element where people start kind of saying, oh God, I saw a cute little American film, the way that they used to say it a lot, and I think they're going to rediscover that In Search of a Midnight Kiss. I think could be In Search of a very big hit for you, Alex Holdridge. Nice. Well, best of luck. I really am very proud that to get you over here. I kind of feel responsible, so it better work. Thanks for coming on Film Weekly, guys.
We'll try to make you look good.
Yeah, thank you.
Alex Holdridge and Sarah Simmons there. And In Search of a Midnight Kiss is on UK release from June the 13th before its US release in August. It could be a summer gem. Go see it. Last week, we were diverted by the excellent celebration of David Lean down at BFI South Bank. And if you haven't heard our highlights show yet, well, it's archived with all our other shows on guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Well, anyway, we missed reviewing the glitziest and most glamorous release of the year. Yes, Sex in the City has high-heeled it from the TV show to the box set to the big screen. Hannah Paul, style columnist with The Guardian, joins me now to review the film. But before we dive into it, give us a chance for a change of costume. Let me slip into my Manolos and hear a clip from the movie.
How often do you guys have sex?
Sex.
Miranda, please.
What? She's 3. She doesn't know what it means.
I'm 41 and I still don't know what it means.
I know, but she is repeating everything.
If I'd known the girl talk was going to be on lockdown, I wouldn't have flown 3,000 miles.
No, we can talk. Let's just not use that word.
Fine. How often do you guys...
color?
Thank you. Well, I can't color enough. I could color all day, every day if I had my way. I would use every crayon in my box.
We get it. You love to color.
So, Hannah, there they are, the four girls together again. Were you excited?
Actually, I wasn't excited. I was dreading it. I thought I was one of those people who loved the series,
but really didn't relish the prospect of a film.
Because normal, the transfer record of small screen to big screen is usually poor.
Yeah, the transfer record is really poor. And also, I slightly resented being so sold to and feeling like I was such a demographic that I was automatically going to rush to this film.
But you are. You're a fashionista. you love your frocks. You love, you know, your culture. Sex and the City's made for you, isn't it? I bet you've got the box set.
I don't have the box set. And I don't have any Manaya's either. But no, there was just something slightly resentful. It felt a little bit like, you know, when the Rolling Stones reel themselves out to fill up their pension pot. And I wasn't that. I wanted to kind of have the memories of, you know, Carrie and the gang nicely and unsullied.
There was a sense, before we even get into the film, that the very fact of the film was slightly sort of out of date already. The credit crunch had started to bite. Did we need to be reminded of the kind of dreamy days of spending on our credit cards?
Yeah, exactly. And what were they going to do? Was it going to be either relentlessly depressing because maybe everything's fun when you're in your 30s but not so fun in your 40s? Was it no longer, you know, it bags aren't no longer as cool, no one can afford them anymore, everyone's thinking about, you know, the environment and lots of kind of big, serious things like that. And, you know, were they going to reference Obama and Clinton? Was everything just going to fit? Were their mobile phones going to look massive in their tiny little hands? Were they going to be eating the wrong kind of sushi? All that sort of stuff. It was a worry.
So were your fears allayed, Hannah?
Firstly, there was a lot wrong with it, definitely. And I went, like I said, with pretty low expectations. And it is cheesy and it is full of stereotypes. And it isn't as well made as I thought it was going to be. It's not even as glamorous as I thought, although maybe my expectations on the glamour front have risen since the TV series. But in spite of all of that, it's really good fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well.
Yes.
Is it a guilty pleasure for me? Maybe it is. I enjoyed the TV show as well very much, actually. I have to say, I always thought it was very witty and very funny. And actually, that was its kind of draw for me, not so much the frocks and the
fashion. Of course,
and
with men, it's always the dialogue that's the draw.
Although I do like a finely turned heel as much as the next man. But I did think that had translated as well. They got the essence of that fine dialogue again. And almost there was a bit where, after about an hour and a half, I thought, Woody Allen, move over. You know, this is recaptured that kind of New York and reflected the New York anyway that Matt Pratt doesn't really exist but that we'd like to see existed. Then it did go on for about another hour and kind of wear my patience slightly thin.
Yeah, I mean, I had the opposite. I was really tense for the first half hour, and I have to say, I watched it. It was at a charity screening at a very nice cinema in Hampstead with a glass of champagne in hand.
Did naked men serve it to you? I've heard screenings have been full of kind of buffed torsos serving.
There were men, but they were clothed.
It's charity.
And they, you know, and that definitely helped, I think, my viewing experience. I have yet to watch it completely sober. And the audience was, I would say, 98% women, 2% gay men, apart from the waiters. And I don't know whether or not that made for a better viewing experience.
But did the women in the audience enjoy it? Because, I mean, let's be honest, it's had a fantastic success. It's kind of actually changed the demographic of cinema, this film. That's why we're kind of reviewing it a couple of weeks late. Because, you know, women have been flocking to this thing. It is the uber chick flick at box office.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so nice. That's one of the things. It's so nice to have a box office where the four leads are women over 40 or around their 40s and above. And that, you know, it's not about watching a kind of sweaty, grunting 60-something-year-old man looking for some bit of treasure and a few bad stunts and explosions. It's women, it's shoes, it's friendship, it's relationships, but it's a blockbuster, and it's got the blockbuster sort of slick, and that's why I think it's done so well.
It is about sex, and it is about, well, Samantha turns 50 in the movie, not to give one of the huge plot points away. All the rest of the girls are 40. It's about having children. It's about keeping on to those friendships. It has been criticised for being rather shallow. I actually thought that, actually, as time went on, the characters gained somewhat in depth.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're criticising Sex and the City for being shallow, you've obviously never seen the series for a start. You know, and it knows it's shallow from the beginning. The characters know, you know, that the whole point is they're struggling with what's a serious thing, what's an ethical problem, what's a big life question, what's just, you know, what's just about the size of your closet or your wardrobe. And I think it's just too easy to say, oh, friendships, shallow, relationships, shallow, shoes, fair enough.
Some of those
I can live with that one.
Some of those heels are pretty deep, though, I have to say. I mean, we get you in here. Well, I mean, you have wonderful insights on literature and art itself. But we get you in here because, basically, you're really good at makeup and fashion as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work in the movie? Because that's where I fall down.
It worked well, although difficult to say what's makeup and what's, let's call it, work. I didn't think it was as glamorous as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a lot more glam. But again, that's probably to do with, and it wasn't as on the moment as I, as it, but then.
That's the trouble with film, isn't it?
That's the trouble with film,
you're always
exactly.
A season behind.
No, I mean, if you know, they weren't all in day glow wearing white plimsolls, but they're not going to be because it was filmed a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
that's always going to be a
problem. So what about the high end of it? Were there some frocks when you thought, great, because there's that wedding sequence where she does the montage. I mean, even I thought some of those dresses were kind of good.
Yeah, the wedding sequence dresses was amazing. The wedding dress was fantastic. Obviously, Vivian Westwood wedding dress is going to be fantastic. Little note from Auntie Viv, fantastic. Everyone in the audience loved it. Of course, of course. And, you know, and I was really pleased that it was, you know, that it was Auntie Viv.
Yeah, rather than some,
rather
you
than
know,
whoever.
French nonsense.
Yeah, or American nonsense. Mm.
My thanks to Hannah Paul there. But there are some other releases vying with Sex and the City for screen space this week, and here are a few in a quick Film Weekly rundown.
As far as I'm concerned, that man's whole body is property of the U.S. Army.
You have to get as far away from me as you can. Go!
There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
The Hulk sees that most intense of actors, Edward Norton, play Dr. Bruce Banner, who turns green when he's angry. Hats off, and shirts, and trousers and shoes, for that matter, to new director Louis Leterrier, who conveniently forgets that Ang Lee, of course, made this film only 5 years ago, and basically does the same story again, only faster, and with less fascination on the perils of messing with science. It's a pretty good job all round, capturing the spirit of the 70s TV show, rather than the comic book, actually, although Liv Tyler is gorgeous, getting the tone just right as a campy comic book love interest. It's all here, action sequence in Brazilian favela, big climax with outsized Tim Roth in Manhattan, Kong-like tenderness and cigar-chomping villainry from William Hurt as evil General Ross. As summer superhero movies goes, it's all good fun and nothing to be too angry about. The Happening, however, is a different matter.
The attacks are spreading. Boston, Philadelphia.
Maryland.
It's all over the country.
Every return of M. Night Shyamalan to the big screen is awaited with eagerness these days. Can he recapture the wonders of The Sixth Sense, or is he slowly creeping into jabbering madness, a self-deluded, self-styled auteur of blockbusters? The Happening points to the latter, I'm afraid, a terribly portentous work that, unfortunately, for all its serious intent, has more in common with Jerry Seinfeld's B-movie rather than the sci-fi scarers of the 1950s. Mark Wahlberg leads a band of survivors through the Pennsylvania countryside after a strange toxin pollutes the New York air, causing people to kill themselves. Cue allegory of post-9/11 terrorist panic, cross-pollinated with an eco-warning about loving the plants and the bees, all topped off with rotten dialogue and a risible performance from Marky Mark, whose expression looks like he's just licked a stinging nettle. Never mind Sixth Sense, you only need a sense of smell to detect this bull.
What's all this about a job?
I wank men off. Wank.
Masturbation?
You masturbate, man. I'm Arena Palm.
Are any of them... are they...
big?
Marianne Faithfull's performance in Arena Palm should be mentioned too, if only because it features the 60s sex siren as a dowdy housewife who, like Belle de Jour, is lured into the sex trade. Except Marianne's doing it to pay for an operation to save her grandson, and her job is wanking off men when they stick their willies through holes in a Soho parlour. Excuse the crudity, but she calls herself the Wanking Widow and becomes so popular for her soft touch that her seedy club owner bills her Arena Palm, the best right hand in Soho. She even ends up with the year's most remarkable screen injury, penis elbow. It's surely the only award this utterly mad film will ever win. Coming up, we'll be meeting Audrey Tautou to find out about her latest film, Priceless. But first, if you love Film Weekly, you should listen to this.
I'm Alok Jha on the latest Science Weekly podcast. Science writer Piers Bozzoni tells us how to build our own spaceships and the future of personal space travel. Also in the show, behind the scenes at an animal research lab. Plus, a cure for hay fever, dancing bees, and more science haikus. That's Science Weekly from The Guardian at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Priceless is a frothy French farce that finds Amélie, actress Audrey Tautou, bringing a bruised depth to her role as a desperate high-class escort in the glamorous but shallow resorts of the Côte d'Azur. I met up with Audrey to find out more. I'm with Audrey Tautou. Bonjour, mademoiselle.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Thank you so much for coming on Film Weekly. Really lovely to see you. Are you okay to do this in English?
Well, I hope so. I will try my best.
Because you, I mean, English is quite an important thing in your career now, isn't it? You've become an international actress.
Well, I become international by with Amélie. But since then, I don't think I've become more international than what I was before.
Yeah, but Amélie was in French, for example, and then Da Vinci Code was in English.
Yes, yeah, okay, yes, if you want.
And Dirty Pretty Things, of course, for Stephen Frears, who we're here in the Electric in Portobello. Yeah. Stephen Frears lives around the corner.
Yeah, that's him who showed me this place.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's why I like to be in this area of London.
It was a very important film for everyone, Dirty Pretty Things, I think, particularly for you, because then that was straight after Amélie, and you came here and you worked with Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's now a big, big star.
Yeah.
And it was a very important film about a certain London of the time, really, about immigration and the people underneath the surface of London. Was it an important film for you in your career?
Oh, yeah, it's really a major movie for me because, as you said, the story was very, very interesting and deep and bright. And also my meeting with Steven was just so powerful. I'm his first fan? No, admirator? Mm-hmm. What do you say?
Fan is good.
Yeah.
Number one fan.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure of that.
Now, your new film, Priceless, or Hors de Prix in French, is very funny, it's very romantic, but there's a certain sadness to your character as well. How do you see your character?
Well, I think that she's a young woman who desperately wants to live in the world of luxury and money, and she's ready to do everything to obtain that. But anyway, she has nothing other than her charms or her body, so well, she tries to catch old men to be married and to have the life she wishes. So her desire is pure, but the way she tries to obtain that can be discussed.
There was, I thought while I was watching it, that there's similarities between what she's doing and what an actress does, uses her body, not to sexually, of course, but to convince and seduce an audience.
Well, the interesting thing for me was that I had never thought about my body before, in fact. And with this movie, I realized that seduction could come with the body and the way you look and the way you dress, and that finally men are easy to seduce when you are just dressed as I'm in the movie. I'm not saying that it will manage with every of them, but it was really interesting for me to discover that I could wear such things without being completely ridiculous.
They're great clothes.
Yes, I think that the costumes in the movie, and also for the co-star Gad Elmaleh, are very cleverly chosen.
Mm. Do you know, did you like wearing that sort of clothes? Is that your sort of fashion? These are very haute couture, very expensive dresses. I don't know who exactly the couturier was. There's some Chanel in there.
Yeah.
Is that the Audrey Tautou, or is that just your character?
Well, me, I'm a bit more shy than my character. They were really, really very sexy for me. And the first time I tried my costumes, I was thinking how my boobs will stay behind this little piece of fabric. I was just obsessed by that. But yes, at this, it took me 2 days just to feel confident and to forget that I was half naked, I would say.
Because she's very different to, I suppose, let's say she's like Amélie. That was a very different character, much more kind of kooky fashion, a much more kind of innocent look on life.
Yeah, that's why I was very interesting to work on this project, because Irene is a character that I don't think that directors can easily think about me in this kind of part. So it was a gift, also because I really have always admired Pierre Salvadori's work. I don't know. I don't think you really know his work here.
Not so well.
But he's very popular in France, and he's very, very talented. He has a special way of writing comedy because they are always very clever, and there's a deep side and I would say dark side inside the comedy. You know, there's always this balance like we can have in life. So it's not like a candy fairy tale.
Tell us about your co-star in this, Gad Emlali, who's not popular in this country yet at all, but I think after this film he will be. He seems very funny, very suave, very good-looking. Who is he?
Well, Gad Elmaleh is a very, very popular actor in France because he's a humorist. He's an actor, but he's a humorist too, and he's very, very well-known about what he's doing when he's alone on stage. So it was a challenge for me to do a comedy with maybe the funniest man in France. And I really hope people will appreciate our duet.
Yes. It seems to me, Audrey, that in a way you are successful in England and in the UK and in America because you embody a certain sort of French femininity for us as foreign watchers. Whereas it's interesting to hear you say that the sophisticated dresses, the kind of classic French couture is not really what you're about. Do you see yourself as in a line of classic French actresses?
It's very difficult for me to define what's a very classical French actress. But, I don't know, Isabelle Huppert or Catherine Deneuve or Jeanne Balibar, you know, it's just... There's a lot of French actresses that I adore, like Charlotte Gainsbourg. But, you know, I'm just me. But apart from that, I can't say that I'm a classical actress in the way that I... That's not the only ambition I have in my life, and I'm not trying to fulfill the dream of becoming... a huge star, and it's not my spirit. I had never been like that.
I remember we met, I think, for a very small French film, He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not, of Laetitia Colombiani, when you were a strange murderess. And you said then that you wanted to become a full actress or a full star. You have many other things that you do.
Yes.
And I see you've got your camera there with you. What are your other atouts, your other aces?
Well, I don't have any other aces, but I have other pleasures in my life. Well, I like traveling. It's always the same thing, but traveling and reading and discovering different way of expressing, you know, me.
Mm-hmm. What are you filming now? What's your next project?
I may shoot a movie about the youth of Coco Chanel in September.
Yeah, with you playing Coco Chanel?
Yeah, when she was young.
Yeah, that's more nice dresses.
Well, not when she was young. It was before, until she starts to be famous and the woman she was.
Well, I look forward to seeing that. Thank Congratulations you. On Hors de Prix, on Priceless. And merci beaucoup d'être
merci.
Ici, de venir nous voir.
Merci, merci. Merci à vous.
Au revoir, Audrey.
Au revoir. Je fais ma petite photo?
Oui, prends une photo. Yes, that was Audrey Tautou taking my photograph at the end. I'd like to think it was just me, but no, Audrey is an avid photographer who photographs everyone who interviews her. She doesn't, she told me, use them as a dartboard. Priceless is on UK release from Friday the 13th. Well, that's all we've got time for this week, other than to congratulate Jun Go on winning our Miramax DVD release competition. We asked how many Kevin Smith films has Ben Affleck appeared in, and Jun got it right. It was 6. They are, of course, Chasing Amy, Dogma, Mallrats, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Jersey Girl, and Clarks 2. So bravo to June, and do check out our blog on guardian.co.uk/film. Last week's discussion of David Lean was very insightful, thanks to all of you who contributed there. And of course, don't forget to pick up the Observer for some trailer trash and the best film news and reviews. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.